Okay, you are tuned to WHPK 88.5 FM in Chicago. You are now listening to the Sitting in the Park show. I have a very special show today because most of the show will be an interview. Today I am not interviewing a member of a Chicago group, but I am interviewing a singer who sang with a whole bunch of groups who performed in and who were based in a whole bunch of different cities across the U.S., a singer named Charles Russell. Charles, can you hear me right now?
Yes, I can.
Okay, great. So, Charles, the reason I have you on the show is because you sang in a bunch of groups that cut a bunch of really excellent records that I play on my show, favorite records of this show. You sang in a group called The Four Dudes and The Image and The New Image and a group called The Three Dudes. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay, so first of all, where are you originally from?
We're from here in San Antonio, Texas, born and raised.
Okay. And how did you originally get involved with music?
Just listening to my older brothers and sisters, just the radio. They're playing, they're singing the songs, and I'm listening to them sing and picking up things. One day I was singing a song that they were singing off the radio, and my mother heard it. And she didn't believe that I was old enough to remember words like that. And I just love music ever since I can remember.
Do you remember some of the early songs that inspired you?
Oh, those were like the Platters. we're talking about way, way back. And because my brother was a teenager at that time, and he always listened to the Platters and groups like that. Moon glows and things like that, and I would just listen and I would learn the words, and I got kind of hooked on harmony from there.
Okay, so you listen to like the early 60s kind of doo-wop harmony groups.
Yes.
And so what was the scene like in San Antonio then? I know there was a lot of like Tex-Mex type groups. Were there a lot of black doo-wop groups in San Antonio?
There were a lot of black doo-wop groups, but also there were Hispanic groups who sung black, and the Raw Gestures and people like that. They were excellent groups, and so it just didn't have a color. It's just a lot of people harmonizing, and that's what it was going on around here.
What about Sonny and the Sunliners?
Sonny and the Sunliners, exactly. He was more. He did everything, but I kind of liked when he would cover some of the James Brown things, but he could also sing some love ballads too.
So were groups like Sonny and the Royal Jesters an influence on you also?
Well, not really, because we all came along at the same time, and I had already. Got my roots from earlier, but I did admire them because we all were singing the same songs.
Okay, so what was the group that you ended up forming, and what was the first group that you formed?
It was the Three Dudes. In high school, when I went from junior high school to high school, I remember the first time I went into the cafeteria. I heard this voice, and I heard a lot of girls screaming, and I said, man, what's that? And I looked, and there was this guy singing a cappella. He was singing a Jerry Butler song, For Your Precious Love, without anybody singing with him. And I said, man, this guy has a terrific voice. So he would do that every day, and so one day I got the courage to go over to him and just start doing some background for him. And he kind of looked at me and kind of gave me the alley, keep going. And then another guy came, and he also joined in. And then everybody, every day, they would say, hey, guys, hey, dudes. I would say, hey, dude, come sing us another song. You know, and so we kind of got started that way. And this guy's name was Reginald Whitaker. And it's so funny because He was a little guy. He was a little guy. But when he got ready to sing, his chest would swell up like a big toad frog, and his big voice come. This voice would come out like a, and he'd sing a Jerry Butler. That man, that was a killer. And that's how we got started. We would just sing around school, walking down the halls, and everybody would be late for class because we'd eventually just stop in the halls and have a little mini concert. Teachers never got mad, and you know they were all, you know, for us, you know. And then it really went over well there. That's when we got started.
And who was the third? Who was the
third?
The third
member was Lawrence Alexander. He was actually more known in the city than we were because that was a local show called Swing Time, and it was kind of like a takeoff of American Bandstand. And he was a regular member, and so everyone knows him from being on Swing Time and dancing on Swing Time.
And so it was a TV show.
Yes, Swing Time was a TV show like American Bandstand. They would bring in Sonny and the Sunliners and people like that, and mostly local groups. They would bring in the Commands, Sonny and the Sunliners, and people like that, Raw Gestures.
So, did you officially come up? Did you officially just take on the name The Three Dudes?
Yes, we did, because everybody was they were calling us, say, "Man, there's some three dudes down there that can sing," and we just kind of like, "Hey, that's not bad. Let's just call ourselves The Three Dudes," and that's how we got started, and that's how we named ourselves.
Was it the first year in high school that you formed?
No, it wasn't. It was the second year in high school. The first year, I can't remember even meeting this guy. I guess we were all kind of new, but it was the second year. It was in 1966, and that's when we formed the group. And we started singing 66, and we stayed together from then on.
And what was the name of your high school?
It was Sam Houston High School here in San Antonio, Texas.
And were there any other groups in your high school that were also, like, performing?
No, not in our high school, but other high schools had groups. We competed against. There was a group called the Justifiers, and there was a group called the Primes, and we all went to different schools. But in our school, I guess we represented our school. We were the only doo-wop group at our school.
So, what was the scene like? Like, was there like across school talent shows that you would perform at? Like, how would you compete against each other?
Yeah, actually, at parties.
Okay, so you would go to a party and you'd battle each other.
Exactly, and it was kind of funny. We always sung a cappella. We never had a band, and this guy from this high school would brag about the group there, and then someone from our high school would brag about us. And so they said, "Hey, well, look, let's just settle this. Oh, there's a party. Let's just you bring your group, and we'll bring our group, and we'll see who the people like the best." And so we said, "Oh, okay, we'll go for that," because we knew we could harmonize, and I knew that Reginald, who did most of the lead singing, we knew he could sing, so we really wasn't afraid to go. But when we got there, they had a full band. and they were dressed like the Temptations. And they had spotlights and everything. And we went on first, and we would always sing impression songs. And so we kind of like did a couple impression songs a cappella, and we thought we was feeling pretty good. And then the Primes came, and they sort of mimicked the Temptations dress. They had a band, full band, just kind of turned it out. So we, from there, we, you know, came home kind of a little dejected and a little, you know, they kind of whipped up on us a little bit. And we said, "Well, you know what? We need more. The first thing we need is another guy. We need to, you know, balance our harmony out." And we started looking for someone, and it just happened that right up the street from where I live, there was a barbershop, And that was a lady who cut hair there.
So you're going to talk about adding a fourth member now?
Yes.
Well, before that, you recorded a record, is that right?
Oh, yes. Right.
So let's talk about that, actually. And it's interesting that you mentioned the Primes and the Justifiers, because all three of your groups each cut one record, and they're all very rare, obscure Texas records.
Right.
So let me play the Three Dudes record, and then let's talk about how the record got recorded, and then we can talk about your fourth member.
Okay.
So this is the Three Dudes record that you recorded. This is called Sad Little Boy.
Okay.
And then we can talk about how it got recorded, and then we can talk about the rest of your story.
Good deal.
Okay, so this is the Three Dudes with Sad Little Boy.
Okay.
Okay, that was just the Three Dudes with their very first record that they recorded. That was called Sad Little Boy. And if you're just tuning in, I have Charles Russell, a member of the group The Three Dudes out of San Antonio, and he is telling his story. So, Charles, how did you end up recording a record?
Well, actually, we got tired of just hearing people say, you guys ought to record. So I went to the telephone book, and I started calling recording studios, and I ran across one, Spatton Records, and the producer there and the owner of the record company, was his name was E.J. Hinkey, and he said, yeah, if you sound good, I'll record you. So he said, y'all come on down, sing. So I went down, and when we sung a song, and he said, "You know what? Y'all can't sing. I would like to record you." So we got all excited, and that's when we decided. We picked out "Sad Little Boy," and he recorded that for us, and I'm Begging You was the flip side.
So who sings lead on Sad Little Boy?
That's Reginald Whittaker.
And who sings lead on I'm Begging You?
And that's myself.
Okay. And did the record get any play in San Antonio?
It got lots and lots of play in San Antonio. It was a one-city hit,
okay.
You could say, because everyone knew us. And that particular song won the talent show at my school, and that was the talk around town. Man, you should have heard these guys sing Sad Little Boy. It was something else. And so by the time the record came out and everybody went and bought it just to hear what it sounds like, you know.
And you had told me that the three dudes had also done some other backup recording work. Is that right?
Yes, we did. The Commands were a group of airmen that did No Time for You. They recorded No Time for You. And when the majority of the group got shipped off, there was the lead singer left. There were two lead singers, actually. One was named Sam Peoples. The other one was named Dan Henderson. Well, Sam Peoples and the rest of the group went back home or got shipped off or whatever. And Dan Henderson wanted to do a follow-up to No Time for You. And at that time, we were out at Abe Epstein's studio. And we kind of was singing for him, and we wanted to, because Abe Epstein had a lot of groups along with the Commands. There was a group called the Webs, a local group. They were very good. And so he wanted to record us, but we didn't get to record with him because our mothers wouldn't sign. We were too young, and at that time you had to be a certain age to sing without parents' consent. So he asked us one day, he called me and said, I can't sign you, but, you know, Dan wants some background, and I told him about you guys and how good you could harmonize. So we said, man, you know, we're not worried about no money or nothing. This would be fun. So we run out there, and we did the background to Chain Gang, which was a follow-up to No Time for You. Of course, you know, no one really knew that was us, but yeah, it was a follow-up for No Time for You, and I think after we did that, I think they formed another Commands with more members. I think Benny Cherry from the Justifiers, and I think he was one of them, and Bobby Shannon, that had a group called the T-Birds, Bobby Shannon and T-Birds, and I think they got together with Dan Henderson, and I think they recorded a song also. I'm not sure, because at that time we were getting ready to leave San Antonio.
Yeah, like they're definitely the Commands cut like two or three records before Chain Gang, and then they did cut a couple records after Chain Gang also.
Right.
So but Chain Gang is the only record that your group sings on. Is that right?
That's right. That's right.
But it's interesting that one of the Commands records is the three dudes actually.
Yeah.
Okay. So you were talking about how you actually were trying to get after you like lost a talent show or a
right.
battle, you were trying to get a fourth member?
Exactly. And there was a barbershop up the street, and I went up there for a haircut one day, and the barber, Mrs. Ball, she said, and you know, it's a small community here and where I live, and so she said, your mom tell me that you're just as crazy about music as my boy. I got a boy in service. He's going to be coming home on leave, but he likes to sing too. And I said, what? And she said, oh, yeah, I can't keep him from singing. I used to have trouble with him because they lived next door to a lounge. And she said, I'd go in his room at 2 o'clock in the morning, and he didn't crawl out the window, and he's over there singing the blues. And I said, oh, this boy, he must can really sing. So I said, well, I'd like to meet this guy. So she said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll tell him to stop down there when he comes back on leave. You know, he's crazy, I'll tell you that. I said, well, he'll fall right in with our group. So when he came, he did stop by, and we kind of kicked it together. And the thing about it is, I fell in love with his voice for different reasons than Reginald. Reginald had this booming, deep, deep baritone voice. This, and his voice was like Sam Cooke, and very gospel, had a very gospel flavor to it. And, of course, the third member of the Three Dudes was a bass. And so I said, well, you know, if I got this guy in, we'd have it covered. We could sing anybody's song, including making up some songs ourselves. And I said, this is probably what we need. Then all we need to do is get a band. And actually, we did, you know, we did get a band. It was a local band, Mickey and the Soul Generations. They wasn't our band, but we kind of fell in with them and sung with them a little bit. But that's how we got the fourth member, and that was in 1968. That was in 1967, no, 68. That was, we had graduated from high school. That was in 1968. So we sung around, and we really fell in love with that sound, because as impressions, you can only do so much. But when you have three members in the background, it would balance off so well. And the way we got so good with the background was, my mother had a station wagon, and we would pretend that we were in the studio, and we would sit in that station wagon. We had a tape, big old tape recorder we'd hook up, and we would sing over and over and over. We'd sing Temptations or whatever, but what we were doing was concentrating on balancing our harmony. And sometimes if someone in the front seat was too loud and I felt like that they just wasn't toning it down, I'd make them sit in the back seat. So I guess you could say that was our first mixing board. But it was, that's how we just practiced over and over and over. And just about everywhere we went, we would sing a cappella with no problem because we were used to it. We enjoyed it, as a matter of fact. We had trouble singing with a band a lot because a lot of bands don't like you to have harmony all the way through a song, and we had to learn how to you know, punch in and out our harmonies to sing with a band. But that's how we got started with the fourth member. And
so you're saying you picked up the fourth member around 68, is that what you're saying?
Yes.
When did the first record come out, around 67, 66?
Yeah, 67.
Okay.
Bad Little Boy.
So then with the fourth member, were you still in high school when you picked up the fourth member?
No, I was in junior college, and he was in the Army. He came down on leave, and that's when we met him.
What was his name again?
His name was Kenneth Ball.
Okay, and so you ended up leaving San Antonio, is that right?
Yes, we did. After we did Sad Little Boy, we kind of, as far as having somewhere to sing other than parties, we had these ideas of we wanted to be in a club and sing to more people and have a more meaningful engagement. So we went to Houston because that was nothing but clubs. I had a brother that was living in Houston, and he said, "You guys need to come here. There's nothing but clubs here," and he was right. In 68, we moved to Houston, and we started going around. There was a guy named Ray Barnett, and he had a lot of clubs, and we kind of got on that circuit and kind of went from there. But, it was a lot of clubs in Houston. That's why we left San Antonio, because San Antonio had one real club, and that was Eastwood Country Club. Of course, that's where all the Etta James and James Brown, anybody, they would come there. But, that's, you know, little teenagers, you know, from local teenagers didn't have a chance to get in there. So we knew we had to go somewhere else to make it. So that's why we left San Antonio.
So you actually were trying to do music full-time, and you went to Houston to play clubs full-time?
We wanted to. Actually, when I went to Houston, I was still in college, and the other guys weren't. But our intentions were to do music full time, which we eventually did because I'd sung so much in the clubs. I just had to let the college go because I didn't get my studies. So we did. After I kind of dropped out of Texas Southern University, we just went around and we just sung. We were picked up by a manager named James Davis, and we went from there.
So so you were, how many days a week were you playing in clubs?
I would say at least four days a week we would plan, and sometimes more than that. It just all depends. He would go out and get us these places to play, and he'd come pick us up and take us and drop us back off, and he had put a band behind us. He had a band also, and he put a band behind us, and we would sing, and also the band had a female vocalist, so we had the whole package, and we really enjoyed that, and so that's how we started on that circuit.
Do you remember the name of the band?
It was I really don't because they just backed us up, you know, mostly.
Okay. How long were you together?
Okay, I take that back. They did back us up, and now I do remember their names before he got them. It was the Heavy Accents.
Yeah, because he put out a record by Billy Richardson and the Heavy Accents.
That's what I was going to tell you. Heavy Accent Band.
Okay, because he put out two records on his label. One was by you, and one was like Billy Richardson and the Heavy Accents or something.
Right. Now, Billy was their lead singer. And so they actually backed us up, and I didn't even know that he recorded them after we, because I guess we had taken off by that time.
Okay, yeah, it's on the same label that you guys are on, actually.
Man, that's amazing you have all this stuff. This is like a music 101. I'm learning stuff.
So first of all, did the exact same lineup of the four dudes go from San Antonio to Houston, or did any members change?
No, it was the same lineup. We went to the same lineup. Kenneth Ball was our fourth member. We went to Houston, and we performed with the same lineup, same guys.
Okay, so how long were you there before he recorded you?
A year.
Okay.
Within that year, he recorded us.
So let me play the record, and we could talk some more.
Okay.
This is one of my favorite records of all time. This record is so nice. And this is you singing lead on the record, right?
Yes.
So this is the four dudes with My Heart Is Broken.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, you're tuned to WHBK 88.5 FM in Chicago. That was just the Four Dudes out of Houston, Texas, with one of my favorite records of all time. That was My Heart is Broken. If you're just tuning in, I have Charles Russell, lead singer of the Four Dudes, on the phone telling the story of his group. So, Charles, who can you give the lineup of the group on that record? Who sings each part on that record?
Okay, myself, I'm doing the lead vocals, and then Reginald Whitaker, Lawrence Alexander, we were the original three dudes, and then the fourth member, Kenneth Ball.
Okay, so one thing I wanted to ask you about is right from the start, pretty much, you were involved with songwriting on your records.
Yes, I was. I always wrote songs, some good, some bad, of course, but that's just something I love to do. When we would practice, we would get together, and I'd just tell the guys, hey, look, guys, this is something I come up with, and their thing was put background to what I did, and they would take just as much pride as getting some unique background, and that's how we actually, we kind of clicked like that.
So how did you learn songwriting? You just, first of all, did you play an instrument?
Well, I could kind of bang on the piano. I could bang out little riffs on the piano. Most people would tell you that a good songwriter writes from the heart. But I'd have to say I'm not a good songwriter because I've only wrote one song from my heart, and that was My Heart is Broken. The rest were, something I thought would be commercial or something with a good, catchy thing to it. But My Heart is Broken, there was a story to that one. I did write that one from my heart. It's a little incident. When we moved from San Antonio to Houston, of course, it all starts with a young lady. I used to have this girlfriend that we went together all in high school, all the time in high school, and I didn't really know how much I really cared for her because my life was music, and I thought that was my only love, was music. And when we got ready to go to Houston, she asked to go with me, and that kind of sounded like getting married or something, and I said, No, I've got to do this music. I ain't got time for that. But I'll be coming back home on the weekends and stuff like that. So when I got to Houston, that back and forth, I was trying to do all of that. And then someone told me that they saw her with another guy at school at the junior college that I had gone to, and she was still going there. So I said, So I said, well, let me do this. I'm going to just surprise her. Go down there and catch her with this guy. And so when I went to the college, my friend said, just sit right here. You're going to be every day around lunchtime, they walk in here. And I said, okay. So I'm sitting there, and here they come, she and another guy. And so she didn't see me, and I didn't approach him because I didn't want to make a real big scene because I hadn't been a saint myself up in Houston, so I didn't want to be that hypocritical. But I said, well, I'm going to make a sweat when I get home and get on the phone. So when I got home, I called her, and I said, well, Viola, I saw you today. So she said, you saw me? You in town? I said, yeah. I was at school, and I was right there in the rec when you walked through there, and you was with a guy. What's going on? And I started ranting and raving. She wasn't saying nothing. I said, don't even try to, come up with a lie or put a spin on it. I'm looking right at y'all, blah, blah. And so she wasn't saying anything. And so I said, hello? So she finally spoke, and she said, I'm confused. And I said, you're confused? She said, yeah. I said, confused about what? Don't tell me you're confused because I'm here and I called you. She said, no. I'm confused because I think I love him. It was just like someone took a brick and slammed him up against my chest. And I was on the phone, and I always sit at my piano in my room when I'm talking to her. And I didn't even have the strength to slam the phone down. This guy took my finger and just kind of eased the button down. And I sat there a minute, and then I started playing the song. And I said, you know, I played it all night, and I sung all night. And I said, you know, before I went to sleep, I said, let me write some of these words down, and maybe I can remember them the next day. And I never did like to do the song because it was depressing, because it was a real-life situation that brought back bad memories. But the guys would always want me to do it. And that's how James Davis picked the song when he met us and he decided to record us. He wanted me to play a lot of my songs. So the guys were saying, my heart is broken. I said, no, anything but that. Because I knew if I played it and he liked it, I'd have to sing it every night. So I didn't want to do that. So finally we got down to play My Hood Is Broke. I said, okay. So I played the song, and when it was over, it was like silence. It was like nothing. Nobody was saying nothing. I looked over at his wife. She was sitting on the other side of the room in a chair. It was like she was about to cry. She said, James, I like that one. He said, yeah, that's the one. So I said, oh, man. So that's how we started doing My Heart Is Broken. And actually, that's my favorite song, too. I was glad when we actually didn't have to sing it when we left Houston and went to Philadelphia. We didn't have to sing it anymore. They had their own writers. So, but that's what I remember about My Heart Is Broken.
Yeah, that's a heavy story, Ben. it's an amazing song though. Like that, all that emotion went into it. Like, I can see why it's hard for you to hear it.
Well, it was not just the memories. It was like if we recorded it, I was thinking, how am I going to get that emotion that I had, you know, when I wrote it? And but then when it kicked off and I heard the drums, and then I get a it all came back to me, and then I got depressed again, and that's when I went on and led the song. But that was my favorite song also.
But to me, like, that's just hearing that song, like, it's one of the, I mean, it's so obscure because it didn't get distributed or promoted because it was on this tiny guy's tiny record label.
Right.
But
exactly.
But it's just like a lost gem, like one of the greatest Sweet Soul records of all time, like, just because of all that emotion that went into it. And it's just so amazing to hear. And then just hearing that story that you told that went into it, like, just adds so much more to the song. Like,
I can't, my cousin took that song to Vietnam with him. And he told me that every night the guys would get together and they'd sit around and they'd write letters back to their wives or girlfriends or whatever. And all they wanted him to do was play that song over and over until they got through writing. And he said, man, you got to give me some copies of it. And I never did. He said, I got all my buddies over here. And he wrote me and asked me to send copies. And he said, man, they were in my tape recorder. At that time, it was a little cassette tape. He said, they were in my tape recorder out. But I never was able to. But he said that he put that on and everybody would start writing letters. And I said, wow, I guess I wasn't the only one that had an effect on.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing that, like, you could record something so powerful and it could not get distributed, but it could still have such an effect on, like, the few people's lives that hear it. And,
right. And
even today, like, people can kind of dig it up, you know, collectors and, you know, people even, like, bootlegging the record now,
yeah.
but kind of recognizing kind of the amazingness of the song.
Like, right.
So,
right.
I mean, I, but definitely it's an amazing record that you put out.
Right.
So did that record get any play in Houston?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes. That matter of fact, that was one guy that was a disc jockey in Houston. Well, they all played it. Everybody played it. But this guy named Boogaloo George, he'd come on late at night. He'd open his show with it most of the time. And not only would he do that, because any time it was raining, the weather was bad, it was sloppy outside, and just a dreary night, he said, "I got something for y'all for tonight." And he would put that on. And everybody would just sit around and mope, you know. And it was just a local hit in Houston. As a matter of fact, it was never played here in San Antonio. It was just a local record there in the Houston area.
Do you remember what year it came out?
That had to be 69. I guess it was 69.
Okay.
Yeah, 69. Yeah, I guess it was 1969.
And how long did you stay in Houston?
We stayed in Houston about 3 or 4 years. A good three years before we left.
Okay. And why did you leave Houston and where did you go?
Well, we went to, after we did My Heart is Broken, we came back, you always go back to your roots, I guess. We came back to Mr. Hinky, the guy who did Sad Little Boy. To make a long story short, we didn't like the way it was turning out up in Houston. So we went back to him and asked him, because he was like our father, you know. And we asked him if he could do another record for us. And he said, sure. And he sent us to Dallas, and we did a record. But this was mostly my doing, because I had a real love for Mr. Hinky. He was just a pure guy. I mean, he didn't care about money. He just wanted to see us do well. And so the guys told me, "Well, hey, look, we want to go big time. We can't do that with a little small label there in San Antonio." And that's basically what he did. Was he kind of sent our song up to Philadelphia. He was kind of hurt when I told him the guys didn't really want to record with him again. We went to Dallas and we did a demo, but it was never pressed. When we got back, the guys that said that, "Hey, look, no, we don't really want to do this. We want to go big time, you know." And so, and then I thought, when I told him this, and this is the kind of person he was, I thought when I told him this, he would probably say, "Well, you know, well, get out and let the door hit you in the backside." But he didn't say that. He said, "Well, Charlie, he called me Charlie. He said, "Charlie, I've got a guy who presses records up in Philadelphia, and he may have some contacts for you. I'll send the songs, Sad Little Boy, or whatever I have, and see if maybe he can get you with someone up there." And which I thought was great, you know.
Wait, so are you saying, I'm confused about one part of the story. You said that, did he record you again and you recorded a demo in Dallas?
No, he didn't record us again.
But you went to Dallas
and
recorded
it. He was going to press that one, that we went to Dallas and did.
Okay, but he never pressed
it. But he never did. That's when the guys kind of like...
Do you remember the name of the song you cut in Dallas?
In Dallas? Please Don't Leave Me.
Did you cut like a dub, like an acetate of it, or did you just have it on tape?
I think it was just it was just on tape.
Does anybody have the tape of it still?
He would. Mr. Hinky would. I'm not sure if he's still alive, but his family may have it.
Okay.
But it was never pressed or anything. It was just a couple records.
Okay.
And actually, it wasn't with a band. It was with a keyboard.
A so it was just like a demo, an unfinished
demo.
Yeah, so he couldn't even have pressed it. He would have had to re-record it.
Right.
Okay. So
right.
So then he sent some just demo material to Philly.
To Philadelphia, and the guy up in Philadelphia, he got back with him and he said, "Hey, look, he presses records for a living. He says I do a lot of things for Gambling Huff and people up here in Philadelphia." And there is a guy named Jimmy Bishop. He's the program director at WDAS in Philadelphia. And I let him hear your tapes, and he said he's interested in the boys. And said that he would like to record them, but he didn't want to do that unless they were free and wasn't bound with a contract. So Mr. Hinkey told me, he said, "Look, I'm not going to keep you guys back. All I want to do is see y'all make it. If you just call me back sometime and let me know you made it, that would be good enough for me." And I thought that was really nice. He said, "I'll give you a release. I'll put it in writing. And you can send it to Jimmy Bishop." And so we did. He gave us a release and sent it to the guy. I'm not sure who the guy was, the guy up there that was doing the press. He had a press in place, and he gave it to Jimmy Bishop, and we did hear back from Jimmy, and he said, "Hey, look, I'm really interested in you guys, and I've got some music, some songs I think that you guys would really, really do good with." And so he said, "But I want to get enough for an album, and so, because I know you're going to be driving all the way up here, and if you got to stay, we need to do an album, so, you know, it'd be worth your while, and you won't be coming back until something kicks off." So he said, "Okay." And when I hung up the phone, I told the guys, and everybody got excited. And one of the guys, I don't know which one, said, "What are we waiting for?" I said, "What do you mean, what are we waiting for? Let's go. I got gas money." And so I said, "We talking about Philadelphia, okay?" "Yeah, we know what we're talking about. Are you coming with us, or are we going to leave you?" I said, "No, I'm getting in the car." We get in the car. We drive all day. And late that night, we go to WDAS in Philadelphia and knocking on. They let us in after the security guard came and said, "Well, who are you guys?" We said, "We're here to see Jimmy Bishop." And he said, "Wait a minute." And he went back, and he came back, and he opened the door, and we went in, and Jimmy Bishop was on the air doing his. He had a late show, some love show, and we're knocking on the window, and he's looking at us like, "Who are these guys?" And we write a note and say, "You know, four dudes." He said, and then he put it on a record, and he came out. He said, "Wait a minute. I just talked to you guys just hours ago." So yeah, and then we jumped in the car and we came up here. And he said, "I don't believe this," but that's how we got up in Philadelphia. He said, "Well, look, do y'all have a place to stay?" We said, "No, we don't have a place." He said, "Wait a minute, let me get this right. You drove from Texas to Philadelphia with no place to stay?" And we said, "Yeah, we was gonna figure that out, even if we had to sleep in the car." And he said, "Well, where are you plan on staying?" We said, we'll sleep in the car." So he said, "Well, do you have any money?" And we said, "We don't have any money. We used our money for gas." He said, "You got to be kidding me. You up here in Philadelphia with no place to stay and no money either and no friends and no relatives. Now, you got it. We just want to sing." And he said, "Y'all crazy." "But you know what?" When I'm looking back on it, we were crazy. I would never do that now, but we were crazy. So it just so happened that he had an abandoned building, a two-story building, that he used to have a lot of groups. And at the time we ran into him, he just had one other group, was a female group, Honey and the Bees. And he said, "Look, I'm going to give you some money for y'all to buy something to eat with for maybe last year, a week or whatever. Y'all try not, you got the hoagies, y'all just try to eat them real slow because, you know, you got to start working before you eat good. You know, we laughed about it, but he put us up in this old building, it's an abandoned building, and what we would do is we would open the windows. It was summertime, but everybody would do that, and just sit in the windows. And then we were right there on the corner of Broad and Girard. It was just a busy avenue, a lot of people walking by. And after we eat our hoagie, and we had some fun with the hoagies because Reggie would eat his fast, and then he'd smack his lips and then look over at us. No, brother, it don't work that way. You should have ate yours slow. But we kind of made it through that rough time. We would sit in the window and look at the people walking by, and we would ask them, do they know anyone that played in a band? Because we had to have a band to make money to live.
You're saying you'd yell from the window?
We would yell from the window. Hey, guys. Hey, guys. And some people thought we were going to mug them, and they'd take off running. But, we finally saw this one guy. And he had, I think it was some kungus he had on it. It was on his back. And yeah, it was. It was little kungus. And he had a set of those, and they were hanging from his back. And we said, and we knew he was a musician, so we said, hey, dude, you play? He said, well, yeah, I play these. And he said, do you know a band? He said, I know guys who play in a band. So we said, wait, right there. We'll be down in a minute. We jumped out of the window. We ran all the way down, and we talked to him, and we told him our story and that we were there, and we were going to starve to death if we didn't find us a band real soon. And he said, well, I got some friends. He was a young guy, real young guy. And as a matter of fact, they were still in high school. And he said, I got some guys, and they play, and, they, you know, we could put a band together. So, and he did. And while he was putting the band together, we was practicing, and we, you know, I think we did a few shows to make a little money. Jimmy Bishop, the producer we went up there to see, was actually getting material together for us to do in the studio. And that's while we were there, and he got Bunny Ziegler to write a song for us. And Bunny was a writer for Gamble and Huff. And he it was kind of funny because Jimmy Bishop and Gamble were real good friends, and he told Gamble, these guys, you got to meet them. They drove all the way up from from Houston with no money. And so he said, he called us over to his house, and Gamble came over. We kind of went upstairs, and he had a little room up there where we just sit around and shoot the breeze. And we just started singing some a cappella things, and Gamble kind of fell in with the bass. And he said, man, you guys can sing. And Jimmy said, well, I told you the guys could sing, and I want to record them. So Gamble said, we got a guy named Bunny Ziegler, and we can get he and Phil Hurt to write a song for him. And so he did, and they wrote a song called Bet You Didn't Know for us. And we recorded that along with Spellbound. Now, that was written by Barbara Mason, and she was really nice, too. She wrote Spellbound for us, and there was another song called Surprise that was written by the Gamble and Huff team. So we did those three.
Okay, well, let me play Bet You Didn't Know, and then we could talk a little bit more.
Okay.
But let me ask one question first is, when you went up there, was it the same four guys as the four dudes?
No, it wasn't. Sorry about that. One guy refused to go. He wanted to get married, and that was our bass singer, Lawrence Alexander. He left the group, and we replaced him with Gerard Green.
How did you know Gerard?
Okay, Gerard Green, his daddy owned Green's Barbecue. We just happened to go in there, and we kind of met him through by chance. And the boy, well, let me go back a little further. The reason why we went in there is a guy down the street who knew we sung. He could hear us singing. We'd have the windows open. He could hear us practicing. He told Gerard that, you know, these guys were up the street and they could really sing, you know. And, you know, so he told us, and we were looking for a fourth guy because we wanted to go to Philadelphia, and Lawrence Alexander, he didn't want to go. He wanted to come back to San Antonio and get married, so couldn't stand in the way of that. So we went to see Gerard Green, and he said, "I already know all about y'all. I've heard y'all's records on radio." And he said, "Man, I know the part that y'all want me to sing." He said, "Y'all want to hit it?" I said, "Is this guy crazy?" But I said, "Okay, let's see if he is crazy." So we kicked off the record. There was a record called My Heart Is Broken that we did with James Davis. And he fell right in with that. I said, "Whoa." You know, and so that's how we got him in the group. And we got him, and then we went to Philadelphia.
Okay, so I'm going to play Bet You Didn't Know, and then we can talk some more.
Okay.
So this is, we'll find out in a second that it wasn't actually released under the name The Four Dudes, but we'll find out the name of the group in a second. But this is, it was released as The Image.
Right.
And it was actually released under another group name, too, which we'll find out in a second. But this is The Image with Bet You Didn't Know.
Okay.
Okay, you're tuned to WHBK 88.5 FM in Chicago. You are listening to the City in the Park show. That was just The Image recorded in Philadelphia. That was Bet You Didn't Know. And if you're just tuning in, I have the lead singer on that record, Charles Russell, telling the story of his group. So Charles was just talking about how he had been in Philadelphia just like a few weeks, and you were just in an abandoned building and kind of trying to get a band together just so you can get money to eat. Is that right?
To eat. That's right.
So did you get a band together that first week?
No, sir. It took us about, I'd say, maybe two weeks, maybe 3 weeks. We'd have to, Jimmy Bishop was our manager at the time. We'd go to WDAS, where he was the program director, and when we run out of money, he'd see us coming. He knew that we hadn't put a band together yet. So, but he was real good about helping us, and he would just advance us a little more money. And he did. We did that for about 3 weeks until one day we ran into a guy. I think a guy that played the congas. And he put a band together for us, and we were able to kind of like go around in town and make a little, you know, money to eat off of until our record came out.
So the band, when you did shows, did you do shows as the Four Dudes originally?
We never did shows as the Four Dudes because when we got there, before we could do shows, we actually recorded and. We wanted to record as the Four Dudes, but Jimmy wanted to change our names to, I'm not taking it back. We had changed our names ourselves to the Choice of Colors. We got away from the Dudes. We said, wait a minute, we were Three Dudes, we went to Four Dudes, now we want a fresh start. Let's name ourselves Choice of Colors. So that's the name we presented to Mr. Bishop.
Okay.
And we started off with Choice of Colors, and he called us one day and said, I had to change your name. And I said, what? He said, well, I was pressing. We were pressing and pressing your record, and it came up that there was already a group called Choice of Colors. And I said, well, what is our name? And he said, Image. I said, The Image? He said, no, just Image. Said, weird. He said, that's your name. I can't, you've already got records cut, so that's your name. I said, okay. So that's how we became Image.
Yeah, you know, I've never seen it, but I talked to someone who said they had it. There's a really rare press of your first record, Bet You Didn't Know, and it actually says Choice of Colors on the record.
Man, that is a rarity.
Yeah.
I did not even, actually, he never told me that any records got out with that name.
Probably he had most of them destroyed and a few got out.
Right. Wow. That is something. I'm learning things.
So he pressed up your record as Image, and
uh-huh.
And Betcha Didn't Know came out.
Right.
And so you actually did shows around town as Image?
Yes. Yeah, we did all on the East Coast as Image. We did Image. We also did Spellbound with Barbara Mason.
So who wrote Bet You Didn't Know?
Bet You Didn't Know was Bunny Ziegler and Phil Hurt.
Okay, and did that record get play?
Oh, yeah, yeah. That got the most play of all of our records. They played it on the East Coast and the West Coast, and especially here in San Antonio. When it got here, I think it was KEDA radio, is a Spanish station, started playing it before the black station started playing it. And they called me and said, man, your record is all over the place here in San Antonio, people going crazy about it. And we got all excited. But as far as I know, it never reached Houston.
Were they playing in San Antonio just because they knew it was you?
Think so. That's how we got our break. I think our first producer, E.J. Hinkey, and I may be wrong, but I'll always think he had something to do with that record getting started here in San Antonio.
That's cool.
That's the kind of guy he was.
So did you ever do any like local TV appearances or anything like that on the strength of that record too?
Local in
like in Philly and
in
stuff?
In Philly, yes. We didn't do any in San Antonio or Houston, but in Philly we did a lot. We did the Georgie Wood Show. We did the Steel Pier. We went to Atlantic City, and then we did a lot of local shows, and had a good time with it too.
And that band you formed, did they become your band actually?
Yes, they did. As a matter of fact, I guess I need to tell you this and tell you how we left Philly. That particular band wanted to be known as the Image, and I didn't have a problem with that. I've always been a guy who didn't mind sharing the spotlight or anything else. But Jimmy Bishop says, no, they're a backup band. They got to understand their backup band, the Image, are the singers. So we said, we'll go tell them. They didn't take it too kindly. So we were supposed to go up in Pennsylvania. I forgot the name of the city. And we came home for Christmas, and we had a booking back in Philadelphia, but it was in Pennsylvania, up east. And when we got up there, we called the guys, the band, and we said, hey, look, we back. We got this. Y'all know about it. We need to go on. So they say, okay, yeah, we'll meet y'all up there. And believe it or not, it was a radio station or something that had sponsored this thing, and they didn't come. yeah, we can laugh now, but boy, that was
not it was not funny for you at the time.
We did two. The guy came. He said, "I don't care if you have a band or not. I'm paying for two shows." He called. He called Jimmy Bishop, and he told him. He said, "I've got all these people here, and they're here to see Image, and they expect to see the Image, and the Image is here, and the Image is going to sing with the band or without the band." We sung two shows, like six or seven songs on each show without any music, just a cappella.
So,
just so we could get out of there.
So what types of songs did you sing on your show besides your singles?
Well, we did ours, of course, but there were a lot of other songs that, the stylistics. We did stylistic-type songs. Or anybody that was out that was, that had a hit song, we would do. And we do those kind of songs. But definitely our songs. That was the scariest night in my life. The people were not too happy because I don't know how much the tickets were. But if I could have given everybody that money back to ensure I would have got out alive, I would have done that. Because you could hear a pin drop every time we finished the song. That was no applause or nothing. Everybody was mad. So we did get out of there, but I don't know if they gave them their money back or what. But that was a scary time in our career.
I bet your a cappella sounded good.
So. Oh yeah, a cappella. Which, you know what? To be honest with you, we drew on our experience of a cappella when we got started before, when we was in high school. We kind of drew on that experience. And it wasn't like that's the first time we sung without music, because we started off that way without a band. So it all went full circle. That experience really came in handy. We made it through the night. I don't know how, but we made it through the night.
And so your second single, Spellbound, which I think I'm going to run out of time, so we're not going to have a chance to play it. It's a fantastic record, but did it get much play?
Yes, but not as much. It was written by Barbara Mason, and it didn't get as much play as the first one, written by Bunny Ziegler and Phil Hurt. Bet you didn't know, but it was a good record also.
Okay, and then you told me some story about how another songwriter offered you another song.
Yes, and maybe we would probably still be up there. If we had taken that one, we would have went another direction, but. A guy named Eli.
But was it Bobby Eli?
Bobby Eli. Had a song called Sideshow. And he came to one of our, we was in Wilmington, Delaware, and we were singing, and he came there and he was saying, I've got a song. Now, he knew us because he was a studio musician at Sigma Sounds. And he said, I got a song that, man, you guys will be great singing. He said, but I talked to Jimmy, and he said he's already got it, your songs lined up. And I'm going to play it for you. Maybe you can go back, if you like it, and talk to him. And he played that song, and I really liked it. I really liked it. And we told Jimmy, hey, look, Bobby Eli came, and he played us a song, and, man, it's good, man. And he said, nope, I already got your songs lined up. We got your songs lined up for the rest of your album. And, well, of course, we didn't do the song. They went to another group, and they formed Blue Magic, and they did it. But we never even got the other songs on the album. When this happened up in, when this band kind of, they didn't show up that night when we went upstate, upstate in Pennsylvania, we decided to come home. So we didn't even finish the album that Jimmy Bishop was going to do on us. And Barbara Mason had written a couple of more songs. And so we never finished that album. And so we just kind of, we came back home then.
So you pretty much left, you only ever recorded those three songs in Philly?
That were released. When we went back up there, and we went to the place where the band didn't show up. Before we came back to San Antonio, we went into the studio and we did some songs. I can't remember the name that Barbara Mason had written for us. Another two or three songs, and that's, we never went back to Philadelphia. When we came back to Texas, we never went back to Philadelphia. So I don't know what happened to those songs, if someone else winded up doing them or what.
So the whole reason you left Philly was just because of one bad experience where your band ditched you?
Right.
Well, how come you gave up your whole career where you were going to have a whole album released and you were going to blow up because of that experience?
I guess you could say the disappointment. It was, well, and that, and you got to remember, since we were in high school, we were never rejected. We were always adored, you know, as far as our musically. And we stood up there and sung a cappella, and these people had paid good money to see us. And they looked like they were going to pull guns and knives on us. They were so mad that, and it really, we were devastated. We didn't know what to do. So we sung two full shows without any music. And really, I guess it kind of just took all of the fire and the will out of us. And we came back home, and we just started singing gospel then.
So do you have any more contact with Jimmy Bishop after that? He must have been mad.
He was very mad.
Okay.
He was mad, but we were mad too. we were not mad at him. Just the way things had turned out, because when that band quit, well, we didn't have a band, and the only way we could eat is to, you know, have a, what we call a gig back in those days. I don't think they even call them that anymore. But a place to play. Well, we didn't have a place to play because we didn't have a band. So we didn't want to starve again. We starved when we first got up to Philadelphia, but we didn't know we were going to starve. That was just something that just happened that we didn't know we was getting into, but we wasn't going to plan to starve. So we decided to come on back and regroup. And he wanted to do an album. Like I said, we did go back up there to do that one. It was way up in Pennsylvania somewhere, I can't remember. And after that bad experience, we did about three more songs that was written by Barbara Mason. And we don't know. We just came back home then, and we were just because we would have to start another group. That means we would have to sit in that window again and talk to everybody walking by again. And that just was overwhelming. We said no. And one of the guys, it was just one guy, Kenneth Ball, was married. And it was putting pressure on his marriage. He had convinced her, we're almost there. We're almost going to make it. And then this happened, and she's like, okay, now what? And he said, well, I'm coming home. So that's what. So that's how we got back back here.
So what year did you go back to Texas?
Okay, that must have been 1974.
Okay, but then you went and you continued to do music, right? Not just gospel, right? You went to California.
Yeah.
So what's the story with that?
Okay. When we went to California, my brother was a big fan of ours, and he wanted me to come out there and record. And then I said, well, what label? He said, who needs a label? He was working as a psychologist, and he said, who needs a label? I said, what do you mean? You need a label? He said, we'll make our own label. I said, you just can't just make your own label. He said, come out here. He said, you just get here, and I'm going to record you. So I went by myself, and I went out there, and we did some songs, and he spent a lot of money. He spent a whole lot of money. I was trying to tell him, because I knew he didn't know. He didn't know anything about the producing side of the business, but he had a desire to make records. He loved records, and he was a record collector. And he just knew that, hey, my brother was the lead singer. I can pay for some musicians, and he did, and he got the best musicians. On one of the songs, he had Wawa Watson and Jim Jameson. He had some people from that did music for Motown. So, he got the best musicians, but it cost him a lot of money.
So the first record he did on you, what was it called? One of the sides was called, he released it just as Charles Russell.
Yes.
And one of the sides was called I Rode Too High on Your Love.
Right.
And what was the other side called?
It Ain't Easy.
And It Ain't Easy was the A side, is that right?
Yes. It Ain't Easy was the A side.
And he released it on a label called Psyche or Psyche?
Psyche, right.
Psyche.
Actually, he was a psychologist, because he majored in psychology. And so this had something to do with the psych part. The only thing I can think of, this came from some of his background, but... So Psych was the label, and it was amazing what he did. He came in not knowing anything about the music business, and he just said, we can do this. Everything that you did in Philadelphia, I can do. And I said, come on, you just don't know. You can't do what Jimmy Bishop did. You can't do. He said, I can do everything they did. But of course, he was a little off on how much it was going to cost him. But I got to give it to him. He went all the way with it. He said, I believe in you. I believe as long as you sing, that, we have a chance to get something done. And he did. And he got him played up there, too. I couldn't believe it.
So that record, I think it came out in 74, actually.
Yeah.
And so that record, it has backing vocals, but is it just you doing overdubs?
The first time it was me doing the overdub.
Okay.
And I once a group member, you're always a group member. I always felt that the song was weak because it didn't have a full complement of singers. I was just so used to hearing the group behind me. I didn't want to hear myself behind me. I wanted to hear the group. And so we did redo some of those songs and with the group.
So then you did a second record on that Psych label, and it was an anti-drug song called Who Needs AD, and it was a song against angel dust.
That's right.
And that came out in 76, which is much earlier than Gil Scott-Heron's angel dust song.
Yeah.
So it was actually recorded as the New Image. So that was that the same group members as the Image?
Yeah, except one. Kenneth Ball was not with us. He had gotten married. Remember, I told you that was one guy who was married, and he said, "Look, I can't." When we was in Philadelphia, he went on back. Well, he didn't go back to California. Actually, none of them moved to California. They just came up and recorded with us. But another guy named Daryl Smith, his last name was Daryl Smith was his last name, yeah. He came up and took Kenneth Ball's place.
Okay.
And we recorded, and we didn't want to call it Image because Jimmy Bishop had the rights to that name.
Okay.
So we call it the New Image.
And the musicianship on it was incredible. You were saying that you had some Motown musicians on it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. James Jameson, Wawa Watson, those guys played for Motown. And they were just incredible. My brother, I think he got tired of hearing me say, you can't do this because, you know, I really didn't want to go backwards, you know, because I was used to Philadelphia, and up there it was like everything was to perfection, and the guys, and he said, I can do everything they do. I said, oh, you can what? And he said, I can do everything they can do. And so, he said, who do you want? I'll empty my, I believe in you. And I have to give him credit. He did believe in me, and he spent a lot of money on me, and he got these guys, and I don't know how. Oh, I do know how. Our arranger was David Crawford, and he did a lot of arranging in Los Angeles. He was a well-known arranger there, and he actually got the guys for my brother. And I said, you got who? He said, yeah. You think you can make it with Motown guys? I said, well, I can't use the music as an excuse. Go ahead and get them. So he got them, and they did the Who Needs A.D., and it was an experience.
And did either song get play on the radio?
Yes. The Who Needs A.D., we had an earlier song, I Think I'll Stay, and that's the one that got played on radio. He called me one day. He had called me, and he says, well, I'm going to take these songs around. I said, no. And my brother's name was Raymond Russell. I said, Raymond, listen to me. You can't take songs around because record company, they're not going to open their doors up to you. You know, you need a promoter to take the song. He said, hey, I'm not going to get nobody to take my song. I'm taking my own song. So I don't know how he did it, but he did take the song around, and he got it he got it on air.
Okay. And then we're running out of time, so I have a few quick questions. So you ended up redoing your first record to Charles Russell as the New Image later on the Bionic label.
Right.
That was also your brother's label, right?
Right.
Why did you redo the song?
Because I told him I wanted to get back with the group. He was trying to encourage me that I could do it by myself. But I told him, Raymond, I've been with a group for so long, I don't want to do anything by myself. And so he said, okay, bring the group up here and we'll record it again. So that's how I got re-recorded.
And I heard that part of the reason you redid it was actually because British people were asking for copies of the original record, and then there was some demand for that. Is that true?
Well, my brother told me they contacted him. He said, and he said that there was a demand for it, and he wanted to redo it. But you know, when we redid it, it wasn't the original. For some reason, they wanted the original.
Yeah, they liked the original versions, not the redone versions.
It was a discotheque that it was a standard there, and they and all the people there wanted that particular, you know. And I had convinced my brother, well, if they like that, they really gonna like it when I bring all the group here. It don't work like
that. Yeah, it didn't work like that. And one final question, because I have like 1 minute left, is you wrote a song for another group, which was a kiddie group.
Yes.
Called Papa's Results, called Sister Sheila. What's the story with that?
Okay, Sister Sheila a guy came to my brother, and he knew the arranger, David Crawford, and he had heard our songs on radio and all of that, and he asked him if he could get him in touch with us so maybe I could write them a song. And I didn't write a song for them. I already had that song, Sister Sheila. And then I wrote another song for them called Bump from the Front. And it got played. And I'm not sure about, but there is some history to the lead singer of Papa Results. He went on and did some incredible things in his career, too, but that's what my brother told me without getting into details.
Okay, and they ended up cutting a second record, too. And was that song used in a movie or something also?
Yes, it was. I'm not sure of the name of the movie, but it was used in a movie. I can't think of the movie, but it was used as a score in a movie. They did the score of it, of the movie, matter of fact. And they did Sister Sheila, and the arranger wrote a song called A Little Bit of Me, and they did that one also in the movie.
Okay. And so, unfortunately, I'm really sorry about this.
Okay.
We run out of time just because you have such a long history.
Sorry about that.
But since then, you've done gospel music. Is that correct?
Yes.
First of all, I want to thank you so much for being on the phone and telling your story.
Man, I've had a blast.
So people can buy your gospel CDs, is that right?
Well, actually, no, because that's been so long ago. That's been about maybe 10 years ago.
Okay.
And so that's probably, it's a relic, too, kind of like our group.
Okay, well, I'll definitely let people know as soon as you have any new material out.
I do appreciate it. Thank you for the interview.
Okay, well, thanks so much for being on there. I'm sorry I have to cut it short right now. The next CD is itching to go on.
Okay.
So,
all right.
Thanks so much, and I'll definitely let people know about anything else you have going on.
Great.
Okay, well, hold on a second, and Bob Minor is up next, so keep tuned.
Okay.